I have a general sense of the field that you're in from the email that I received from William Zartman and some other things. But before we officially begin the interview, I'd like to gain a better understanding of your background. So please tell me anything you think would be particularly helpful for me to know about your work, your current work, your background, before we begin.
So I'm in the field for about more than three decades. And originally my subject was the Soviet-American relationship in the days of the Cold War. Mainly the conflicts in the Soviet-American relationship, including the theory of conflict, the strategy of conflict, resolution of conflict, crisis management, negotiations, and conflict resolution, of course. As well, I was, of course, engaged in the research not only of the direct Soviet-American conflict, but also some other conflicts which you have already mentioned, like the Middle East, Vietnam, Korea, some other regional conflicts, mainly in the periphery of the Soviet Union, of the then Soviet Union. Since then, of course, I was engaged in some both open and closed research of this subject, preparing some position papers and policy papers for the government, but also publishing widely, in both in Russian and in English. And I think that maybe the best years or days in my research are behind, because the most exciting period was, of course, the resolution of the Soviet-American conflict, that is the end of the Cold War, when I was currently engaged in the research and also in preparing some of the practical solutions. Also was in very close contact with my American colleagues on the problem of the conflict resolution, including Bill Zartman, whom you know, but also the different projects at the Harvard University, at the Brown University, in Berkeley. And so that helped me, you know, to conduct research not only within the Soviet system, or that is within the Soviet research centers, but also the international centers. That also helped me to begin some international research projects, like the negotiations research at IASA, that is International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis. At the Salzburg seminar, and in some other research places in Europe and the United States. Recently, now I am mainly engaged in Russian foreign policy making, Russian-American relations, Russian policy in the West and in the East. Also, some time, of course, I have to pay to the problems of the Russian attitudes towards different conflicts. In any way, my maybe best work was published on conflicts in and around Russia. It was published in 1994 in English in the Greenwood Publishers in the United States. So this is my widely my background, the areas where I worked, and the subjects which I touched in my research.
That's very helpful, and I'm sure we'll come back to some of the things that you mentioned. Right now, it will be helpful for me to gain a better understanding of how you think about enduring conflict situations or these intractable conflict situations.
Well, I think, you know, that there is a certain unexpected development in this area, because when the Cold War ended, there was a feeling, and I think rather widespread both in this country and in the international community, that opened a possibility to put an end to almost all the conflicts, including the intractable conflicts. at least there was such an enthusiasm shared by many people in the United Nations, in say separate nations, that, you know, that we can move on and work out solutions of almost all of the conflict which existed. And of course that was supported somehow by the developments in South Africa, in Afghanistan, in even in the Middle East, where the possibility of some direct Arab-Israeli talks was opened. I think that now, of course, those days are behind, and now we are facing the situation that not all the conflicts were solved, and not all the conflicts can be solved. Still, you know, we have the very significant or very important situation when the conflicts continue, not only because of some civilizational things, not only because of the gap between the rich and the poor, but simply, you know, because the human society has not yet grown up to the level when it can really put an end to the conflicts. The human society still needs some conflicts to go ahead, to develop. And this concerns not only the, say, the group of the backward nations, which are simply in the situation when they cannot live without conflicts. I mean, the group of the nations which were labeled like the axis of evil or the rogue states, but only more developed nations. They still also, you know, just are in the stage when they need and they prefer the conflictual development rather than non-conflictual development. So still the problem of the conflicts continue to be extremely, extremely important. It needs, of course, continuation of the research on the problems of management of the conflicts. Still, you know, the possibilities of the both old conflicts and new conflicts is still very high. And the effort, you know, by the international community to undertake something, to do something to overcome this conflict is still ahead, not behind. It also, of course, includes such new, say, quote-unquote, new areas like terrorism, like some illegal activities, drugs, and so on. But mainly this is still the problem of the human thinking, you know, because the human thinking very often, even in the developed nations, prefers, you know, the controversial, you know, the development rather than some development based on the search for consensus.
Human thinking prefers the controversial rather than the consensus.
Non-controversial, you know, rather than search for the consensus.
Can you tell me more about the, is that a kind of theory, the problem of human thinking, or is that just the words that you're using today?
it's a combination, you know, the human thinking, the patterns of the human thinking, and the real situation in some parts of the world. The problem, you know, now simply now has changed because of this globalization trends, you know, which has changed the situation in the international relations into a, say, much more dramatic than it had been previously because of this several groups of nations which have emerged. The group, what I call the successful nations, you know, the nations of the West, you know, which have achieved rather high development of stability, rather high development of the human relations, of the respect to the human rights and the capability to provide the basic human needs to the members of the society. Then the group of the nations which, let's say, try to become successful but still are far from there, like Russia or China or India or Iran or the others, the nations which try to work out some sensible development strategy but still are far from the desirable level. And then the group of the, failed states, you know, the states which still exist, you know, something like the Stone Age, you know, they are backward, they are poor, they are ravaged with the conflicts, And, you know, just the problem is that the more developed, more civilized states, they cannot work out a sensible strategy. Very often they prefer, instead of some sensible strategy, they prefer simply use of force, calling it counter-terrorist strategy or something like that. But, you know, at least they rely mainly on the coercion, on the violence, rather than on the attempts, you know, somehow to change the situation in the backward areas of the world. So that's what I mean when I say that it appeared, you know, that so very often even the developed nations, they prefer simply to use violence rather than to work out some sensible solution.
And what do you think is the cause underlying those? The strategy to use violence rather than working out a solution?
Well, if to say briefly, I think that Huntington has described it rather brilliantly, clash of civilizations. You know, in which the more developed civilizations, you know, they, due to the fact of their power, they acquire a lot of arrogance, and instead of trying to do something to help to the younger brothers, you know, they prefer to be the sheriffs, you know, just to assume the position of the police, of the policeman. And that, of course, puts the problem of conflict into an impasse, because that somehow that makes the conflict inevitable, you know. That makes the conflict perpetuates the conflicts.
So there's some responsibility that the more developed nations are not taking, and if they would take that responsibility more seriously, it sounds like you're saying you think it would help.
Yeah, it's a challenge, you know, first of all, for the more developed nations, you know, because either they feel the leaders of the whole universe, and that would mean, of course, a totally different strategy and totally different level of responsibility, or they feel, you know, that they are the best among the others, and they would prefer simply to defend their interests against anyone, you know, just the barbarians or terrorists or poor people or, say, religious fanatics. But in any way, just if they simply regard themselves as bastions, as enclaves, as fortresses, and that's why they have this strategy of something like strategy of coercion, you know, which I say perpetuates the conflict, because in this way they can put an end to the conflict only if they simply annihilate their enemies.
Now, if we asked you to help in such kinds of situations, how would you approach them, or what would you do?
Well, I would begin maybe with some very good and careful inventory of the whole state of affairs in the world, you know, just as maybe along the lines that I have already outlined, you know, the new groups of the nations, the identification of the most dangerous, of the most unstable pieces in this relationship, maybe poverty, maybe, you know, just the feeling of desperation or frustration among the whole groups of the population in the whole areas, and then maybe working out some appropriate strategy for these people to help them to overcome their current situation. So to reduce the amount of the people who would prefer some violent solution, to work carefully, you know, to encourage those people in these nations which would be appropriate, you know, for some constructive development and so on. But that should not be carried out as an individual effort of any nation, including the United States. That should be taken out as the global effort, one of the purposes of the global community. The second, of course, I would put in the question of the responsibility of those governments which still continue to use violence against some people in their nations or abroad, like Chechnya, or like Iraq, like Afghanistan, you know, because, you know, just we understand that very often, you know, just simply the use of force, which is described as a way of solution, leads to nowhere. It leads simply to the deepening of the conflict, you know. It leads to the new stages of the destruction, you know, instead of any constructive development. So the responsibility of the governments for their policies. Then third, maybe, you know, something like a sensible international global strategy, you know, just to reduce the sources of this conflict and to create the conditions to overcome this conflict, to put an end to them. Conflict resolution effort, especially in such areas which you label as intractable conflicts. The Middle East, India, Pakistan, Korea, you know, the others, you know, not to bomb them, but really to help them and to encourage them to look for some constructive solutions. So maybe some others, you know, educational measures and some others should also be taken, but at least these three areas of actions would be absolutely indispensable in order to overcome the existing conflicts and to avoid the conflicts in the future.
So you just mentioned three different ways that you might approach these kinds of conflicts.
Yeah.
Let me repeat back what I think I heard you say to make sure I've got it right. The first piece of what you said was that you think there should be some kind of international, global effort to help different nations encourage less violence, reduce violence among the people, and that it should not just be a United States-led effort, but really a global effort.
That's right.
The second one that you mentioned is that there should be responsibility placed on the governments who do use violence against their own or other people, such as in Chechnya, Iraq, Iran.
That's right.
Other places. And then the third seems similar to the first. Tell me if
I... No. The first task sounds a bit, you know, wide. But it means, you know, just something like a strategy to avoid the conflicts in the future and to reduce the possibility for the current conflicts. While the third one is a more or less concrete, specific conflict resolution strategy for those areas where they exist and where they have acquired, you know, the intractability.
Okay. And when you talk about an international global strategy or effort,
yeah,
can you say more about how do you envision that? What is that?
Well, I tried to write about that and even publish in our newsletter. You know, it's identification of the sources of the possible conflicts in the future, like environmental conflicts, you know, caused by the different, say, consequences of the global development for the environment, like Kyoto Protocol and so on, because different nations would suffer differently because of the consequences. Like the resources wars, because of the inequality of the resources distribution in the world, you know, and the need of different nations to have an access to the resources, which they don't have, but they need badly, like, say, electric power or other sources of power. Then the population wars, you know, caused by the inability, you know, just of large sections of the population to simply survive in some areas, you know, and what forces them to emigrate, to get access to some better organized societies, like, you know, just millions of people who want to emigrate to the United States or to Europe or to some developed nations in Asia, you know. So, and the war is based on impossibility of some societies to to take in all those amounts of the people who want to emigrate. So the war is based on the inequality of the development, inequality of the resources distribution, on the inequality of many other things, inequality of the consequences of the industrial development for the environment and so on. So first of all, I think a large effort should be taken to try to identify where can we expect the conflicts, why they should come. I'm excluding now ideological conflicts, I'm excluding maybe conflicts based on some religious differences, because more or less they are known, and we have already the knowledge how what to do with them, but not with the others. And then on the basis of this inventory, you know, just to try to work out sensible strategies, how can all these conflicts, expected conflicts, be treated? What should be done for this purpose? What resources we need? What strategies should be worked out? And what purposes should be set? You know, just how can we avoid all these population wars or resources wars and environmental wars and so on? This is roughly what I think about this part of the subject.
And so there would be some kind of international or global group that would get together and help all around the world in different conflict situations?
You know, I don't think particularly of any one agency, you know, but we have already enough of the international groups, forums, and so on. Like, for example, the G8 could do something here, and as far as I know, the G8 is trying to do, you know, there is something like an effort within that group on the conflict identification and the problems of working out the relevant strategy. The UN, of course, can do something about it. NATO can do within its area of responsibility. Other regional organizations. So we have the mechanisms. The problem is simply to give the people the sense, you know, of where are the problems related to the conflicts exist, and what they should do in order to avoid that. Because I say, you know, if we set as a moral principle that there will be no more violent solutions, maybe only in some cases when really we have to do with some criminals, like maybe the narco barons in the Latin America, but mainly, you know, as a principle, no more violent solutions. Only non-violent solutions, legally based, the solutions are oriented towards the use of some economic measures, social, cultural measures, educational effort. In that sense, you know, just of course, we should need all these mechanisms simply to start working.
And is there some theoretical material or background that informs the approach that you're suggesting?
Yes. Yes, of course, of course. Now, I have completed maybe a month or 2 months ago an article for some Russian theoretical magazine on the conflict management, you know, in the current situation. Of course, that needs some additional theoretical research. Not so much maybe on the strategy of conflict, because that is more or less was worked out during the days of the Cold War. I think it simply should be stressed on conflict resolution and conflict management, you know, these two disciplines. Conflict resolution is also more or less, you know, worked out. Maybe it simply needs some additional things. I think that what I would suggest is conflict management is something, a new thing, you know, which should become something like a cover notion for all the efforts which concern the conflict, the subject of the conflict. That is conflict control, conflict avoidance, conflict resolution. All these subjects should go under this major cap of the conflict management, which still needs a rather, I would say, intensive international research. What is the conflict management? What purposes it should bear? What type of mechanisms should be suggested, what types of strategies these mechanisms should carry out in order to put the existing and the possible future conflicts under some on some manageable grounds.
So, again, I'll repeat back what I think you just said so that we can go deeper into some of the things you said. So it sounds like you feel there are two different areas here. One would be conflict resolution and the other is conflict management. And under conflict management includes conflict control, conflict avoidance, and conflict
resolution.
Okay.
Yes.
Can you say more about each of those three, conflict control, conflict avoidance, and conflict resolution, and how you envision those?
I have to think, you know, because some of them are, as I say, you know, are more or less known and already studied in depth, both at the UN level and in different national research centers like Wills Artman in the US, or many other people, you know, in the US, like the people who make research on conflict resolution in the Ann Arbor in the US. So I think that you know maybe even more than me about these people who work in those areas. I mean the conflict resolution as such. Conflict control is a bit different, but it also was worked out by the, mainly it was, the ideas were spelled by the UN, by the US-UN Association. There was even such a work called Controlling the Conflicts. It was still in the 70s, but the ideas which were laid down, I think, are still applicable for this subject even today. Conflict avoidance was the subject, I think, mainly awarded by the former UN Secretary General Boutros Ghali. He has said this is a subject in the 90s when, I say, there was a euphoria among the leading nations which felt, you know, that they can deal with all the conflicts, they can put the end to all the conflicts, and as is a top purpose of that was this problem of conflict avoidance, that is, what to do to avoid the conflicts in the future. So I think that these different subjects, they were worked out sometimes, you know, because of some specific tasks, like, for example, the Cold War, or in some cases when the people simply wanted to use the existing facilities like the UN Association of the United States. Now I say, you know, just all these, even there was the concept of the conflict reduction, which was worked out together jointly by Bill Zartman and myself, and we have made even a book on that in 95. But now I feel simply that all these separate disciplines should be put together under this cover of the conflict management, and the subject of the conflict management should be spelled out as a purpose of the global community.
Okay. You've talked a little bit about this already.
Yeah.
In an ideal world, what do you believe needs to happen to deal with these kinds of situations that we're talking about?
In the ideal world? I don't know what is the ideal world.
Oh.
We have the world that we have. Simply, simply, you know, very often the world changes because of what we are doing or not doing, you know. So I think, you know, that the fact that now we are facing again this row of the intractable conflicts and the row of the possible conflicts is the result of the failure by the leading nations of the world to use the opportunity which was opened with the end of the Cold War and to start the program of the conflict resolution or conflict management more intensively, you know. Instead of that, the nations somewhat relaxed, you know, and they have simply missed the opportunity to work hard on that. That's why, you know, this was gap growing between the developed and less developed nations. That's why, you know, just some areas in the world have appeared which are simply producing conflicts almost daily. I mean, the poor nations in Africa, the nations like Afghanistan or Sri Lanka or Bangladesh or Pakistan, in Asia, you know, or the poor nations in the Latin America which produce, you know, all these drug problems and so on. So I think that, you know, to a large extent, it was the responsibility or the result of the lack of responsibility on the part of the leading nations that we have run into these problems, you know. So now this is the high time, you know, to understand for these nations that they have to unite their forces. They have to work out something like a code of conduct, like it was in the last days of the Cold War, which would help at least to avoid creating the situations like similar to Chechnya, you know, creating the situations when the conflicts would be simply perpetuated and become really intractable. So first of all, to work out the code of conflict for themselves, and then on the basis of that to start working with the existing or potential adversaries and to try to prove them, you know, just to also to accept some rules of conduct, you know. As I say, you know, because to a large extent my background was based on the Cold War relationship, and I remember how important there was the problem of the working out the code of conduct between the two superpowers, and thus maybe to lead to the end of the conflict relations between them. Something similar should be done right now between that part of the world community which may be called as responsible and forward-looking, and the other part of the world community. I would avoid to call them irresponsible, but still, you know, to the other part of the world community which still seeks conflicts, which still seeks some benefit in subversion of the existing order.
And what is the purpose of the code of conduct?
The purpose, first of all, is not to do something which may lead to the aggravation of the conflict, not to undertake some forays against the other nations, which maybe are not that developed as the more developed nations, but still we should not be treated as simply, you know, sites of their air force exercises or so on. So to say, to take some code of conduct which would avoid, which would prevent, you know, the possibilities when the more developed nations create the conflicts because of their arrogance and because of their inability to work out some peaceful strategy. That's number one. And then number two of this conflict conduct is to suggest to the adversaries, which exist right now, people like, I don't know, like Ayatollahs, for example, in Iran, or the leadership of the North Korea, to suggest to them this conduct and to make sure that they could respond somehow constructively to these proposals. I think, you know, that there is simply no other way.
So is the idea behind the code of conduct that there would be a equal codes, the same codes for everyone all around the world?
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. You know, something which is based on the UN Charter. We have the UN Charter, but you understand it, as usual, you know, I think Orwell was saying that there are always, we all are equal, but there are more equal than the others, you know. So we should work out the standards of the conduct, the standards of the behavior, which would really just give a possibility to all the nations somehow to feel that, you know, they are respected and that they can hope for some better future. Not to put them into the position of rogue states, you know, which are simply maybe labeled as, you know, just the game for the huntings, you know, for the hunters, or in the position of the excess of evil, you know, when they feel, you know, that they are simply doomed to be bombed one day. So to avoid such situations, I think that this is much more promising than simply to prepare the armed forces.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've mentioned a couple of times in our conversation the idea that we are in some kind of evolution, that's my word, but evolution of the world where we've come from warring states and we're moving towards a more peaceful world. Do I have it right? Is that part of your thinking about
yes.
resolving conflict?
Yeah, but no, but simply, you know, just this depends on what we are doing today. There is a chance, you know, that we may move from one world, one type of the world, into another type of the world. There is a strong chance because of the globalization, because of the existing of this global community. But that doesn't mean that it will happen automatically. It may happen only if we do something for that. If we don't, then, of course, we are doomed to have the situation where we shall have an America fortress, for example, in the North American hemisphere, maybe some other developed enclaves which would be increasing their military capability to defend themselves against the barbarians like NATO countries and so on, and all the rest of the world which will be simply poor, savage, looking with some greediness, you know, at the more developed nations. So we shall have the situation which I label, you know, in some of my writings as Rome and the barbarians. The situation where Rome will inevitably be run over by the barbarians sooner or later, because, you know, these people have nothing to lose. They want better living, and they think that their only way to the better living is to conquer the Rome. And sooner or later they will do it. So to avoid that, of course, we need some different philosophy.
The different philosophy being conflict resolution, globalization.
Yes, that's right, yes.
Okay. If you could use a metaphor or an image to describe the kinds of situations that we're talking about, what metaphors or images would you use, and why would you use them? Take a moment to think about that. That's always a hard one for folks.
No. What type of situations you mean? You know, for example, if to describe the current situation regarding the United States strategy, it's of course the world's policeman. You know, what I was when I was commenting, you know, some of the decisions by your administration, I said that, you know, at least 2 years ago, it had a choice. To become either the world's leader, a good father, you know, creating something like paternalistic relations between the U.S. and the nations which need mostly the U.S. attention and U.S. generosity. And the other alternative was to become a policeman, you know, just a tough policeman, and to hunt for the criminals, you know. So, and the choice was made by the American administration to become a policeman, which sounds maybe more attractable, which maybe attracts some more support on the part of the American public, but I think, you know, which was very short-sighted, because inevitably it will put on the U.S. with all its, of course, undeniable achievements into the position of defending country, you know, the country fortress, because it will be hated, because it will be regarded as a hostile force by the billions of people in the world, in the rest of the world. So this is one of the types of the metaphors that I am using in my analysis.
Mm-hmm. And are there any metaphors you're thinking of to describe the conflict situations themselves? You described a metaphor for the interveners. Well, the way that I'm thinking about the interveners in the conflict situation.
No, frankly, no, well, of course, I think, you know, there can be some metaphors, like, for example, the troublemakers, you know, because we have always to look after them. But we equally have to be very cautious in choosing or in separating the troublemakers from the rest of the people, because in every nation, Islamic nation or not, you will have these troublemakers who would raise noise, who would declare some holy wars, you know, on the infidels and so on, which does not need, you know, that the rest of the society shares their goals. Simply, the rest of the societies either have no possibility to spell out their goals, or simply it is ignored, simply it is under the domination of these people. So there should be a very careful policy in doing that. Like, for example, take the Iraq and the situation in Iraq. I think that on one hand, of course, the American operation there was extremely successful because it has managed, you know, to put an end to one of the most dictatorial regimes in the current world. But something was made wrong, you know, or something was not made, which has forced the Iraqis now to resist against this, you know, which now makes the conflict intractable. So the question is, what was not done? Who is responsible for that? Why the possibility, you know, just to put a real end to the conflict was not realized? Where were the mistakes? And I think to a large extent, the answer to these questions should be given through what I'm trying to talk about. That is, no ideas of conflict management, you know. The half-baked idea of dealing a blow and after that I don't care anymore, which is wrong. Well, but that has very, very little to do with your question metaphors, but simply cannot think about any other metaphor right now.
Okay. So earlier in our conversation, you mentioned that it would be helpful to identify future sources of conflict, such as environmental conflict, resource wars, need of different countries to have access to resources, population wars. And after that, you mentioned that these are particularly helpful for us to think about and that they're different from ideological or religious conflicts. And when you spoke about the ideological and religious ones, you mentioned that you felt we had already figured out kinds of solutions or ways to deal with those conflicts. Did I hear you correctly in saying that? And if I did...
Not exactly, you know, because I wouldn't say that we know what to do with those. At least, you know, this type of the conflict is known to us. At least, you know, Samuel Huntington, in his work on the Clash of Civilizations, has really touched this side of the problem, that is, the impact of of religion on the conflicts, you know, the impact of the ideologies, you know, and so on and so on. So at least this is a known evil for us. I hope, you know, maybe I'm exaggerating, you know, our abilities, but at least I hope that we know what to do with them. But so far we have not studied yet the relation between these ideological or religious sides and the problems which are related to the, I say, inequality of the resources, inequality of the possibilities, the inequality of the expectations for the billions of the people. Very often, you know, what we label as a religious war in reality is a resources war, and vice versa.
Can you say more about that? How is that so?
Beg your pardon?
So, in the case where we think something is a religious war, but it's really a resources war, is that because you're saying people are making...
Oh, yes, of course, I understand, yes. Recently, I read something in the Russian press, you know, an article which really just made me feel furious, you know, because the person there was writing about terrorism and hinting, you know, that terrorism is very tightly connected to the Islam as a religion, you know. And I thought that either the person is simply illiterate and does not know many things, or he's writing because someone asked him to write that, because of course, Islam may be labeled as a religion, you know, which, so to say, is very tightly connected to fanaticism, or which can produce conflicts very often. But the problem is that mainly the Islamic people, you know, they live in the poor countries. There are among them rich countries like Saudi Arabia, for example, or Kuwait, but they are not very numerous, you know. The rest of the Muslim world, which is almost 1 billion people, are poor, backward, illiterate. They suffer, you know, they are undernourished, you know, they suffer the diseases. no one cares with their own rulers how to help them. But at the same time, of course, you know, the expectations of those millions of the people, their desires, you know, they are framed as ideological conflict with the infidel West. And many researchers even, they take, you know, this as the truth. And they say, yeah, you see, you know, Islam is so much, you know, just so much aggressive and so on. It is not aggressive. It reflects the feelings of the desperate people.
That's very interesting. So you're saying the conflicts arise and show themselves to be ideologically or religiously based, when in fact the feelings of desperation that lead to terrorist acts actually come from people feeling undernourished and poor and don't have enough.
That's right, you know, especially in the current world, I say globalized world, you know, when it maybe was much more much easier to live, say, 100 years ago, when millions of people somewhere in Egypt or in some other, they never knew anything about America or the high standards of living in the more developed nations. They lived their traditional life. But due to the globalization, this isolation was broken. And now millions of people in India or in Bangladesh or in any other, you know, just poor country, they know that there are other nations which live much better. Or millions of people here in Russia, they also know, they have seen movies, you know, they have seen other TV programs, and they know that in other nations the people live much better, you know. So the problem is now, what to do with their desire to live better? Can it be framed as a constructive force which will make the people become more active for reforms, for changing their lives and so on, or it may be used to frame up hostility towards the richer countries, to say that you are poor because they are rich, to frame the whole attitude in the terms of the zero-sum game. If you want to become richer, they should be robbed, you know. So this is the only possibility for you to become richer. Then, of course, that will be framed as an ideological conflict. In that case, the communistic ideology will come back, and the millions of people would believe again that to make their lives better, they should attack and destroy the bastions of capitalism. Or, if to speak about the Islamic world, so for those people, also the millions of those people, if they want to make their lives better, they have to attack and to fight against the infidels and to take part of their wealth and to share it.
I can see that you care very passionately about these issues. And it's very...
Yeah, because I live in the country, you know, which has only 10 years as leaving behind, you know, this the burden of the communistic ideology, which was also making all us the enemies of the U.S. of the West, you know, and feeling that we had our poor life simply because someone was robbing us. But in reality, it was the communistic nomenclatura which was robbing us, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's a part of my life. That's why I'm responding in this way. But at the same time, I'm trying to think about all those hundreds of millions of the people who still live in the poor world, in the world where they have no hope for tomorrow, you know, when they don't know what to do, how to live, and that's why they are becoming the victims, or the victims of the propaganda of the local, say, some propagandists, and these propagandists turn them against the United States and the West. This what makes me feel very passionate and very, you know, why the U.S. is working in the same direction, why the U.S. government is doing the things which really supports these ideas.
Which really supports the...
Well, the views of the propagandists, of those who agitate, you know, against the West, because the West is the enemy, they say. Yes, the one who bombs us, who makes... or who kills my friends or my relatives or my children, of course, is my enemy.
And you're saying the U.S. plays into that by continuing the violence?
Unfortunately, yes. Unfortunately, yes. Because, you know, just now I feel, since I'm working in the Institute of U.S. and Canada Studies, you know, and I'm studying, you know, the situation of the U.S. and the world, and I feel that the image of the U.S. as the hope, as the source of hope for the millions of people now is changing into the image of the source of hostility, source of threat.
Yeah.
This is something extremely important for the future.
Mm-hmm. You just mentioned one of the places that you're working. And before we close, I have a couple of closing questions for you. One of which, can you describe a little bit about the PIN group that you're working on with Professor Zartman and and any of the other current things that you're doing that would be helpful for us to know?
Oh, yes, of course. Of course. So, first, a few lines about the location, which is the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis, a think tank established jointly by the United States and the Soviet Union in the early 70s to work together on the subjects of which we were talking, and that is resources development, population development, energy, and other quote-unquote non-political matters. So the very fruitful idea spelled out by the very clever and responsible people in the midst of the Cold War that we should combine our forces to work on the subjects which would determine our future. And as an addition to that, the idea which was spelled by the first American director of that institute, Howard Rafer, that is, we should also study the process of negotiations, because there is no other way how these problems may be solved but only through negotiations. So to say, from the very beginning, it was a choice: no conflict, no imposition, no coercion, only negotiations. So, and I was maybe among the first Soviets who were sent there in early 80s to try to begin this project on the studies of the international negotiations, and second, how to make the process of international negotiations a part of the solution of the international problems. Several years we spent, you know, just in looking for the partners in this project, sources of funding, and finally it was on the generous support of the Carnegie Corporation of New York that finally this project was launched in the, I think, year of 86 or 87. The format which was suggested by the then director of the institute, who was Bob Pry from the United States, a very clever person, was that there should be a steering committee for this project, which would incorporate the people from different cultures, like myself, a Soviet, two Americans, Bill Zartman and Jeff Rubin, the late Jeff Rubin from the program on negotiations at the Harvard University, a Swedish, a German, an Austrian, a French. So it was a host of the international scholars coming from different disciplines like history as myself, or political sciences, Bill Zartman, or lawyers like the Austrian, mathematician, the German, and so on, which were decided to unite their knowledge, their connections, their views, in order to work out something like a generally accepted negotiation strategies. And since then we work, we meet there regularly 3 times a year, there or in some other nations where we make road shows, and we set the subjects for, or the topics for our book projects, and thus we have already published something like a dozen of the books on the different aspects of the negotiation process, including the opening book which I edited on the international negotiation, which was a real success, and was there was a second edition published by Josie Bess in year 2002. By the way, the book was has received the Book Award of the CPR Institute of Conflict or Dispute Resolution. Mm-hmm. So still we have something like another dozen of the books in the pipeline coming up. So this is what we are doing. That is working together and contributing into the understanding, general understanding of the different aspects of the international negotiations. And the second, of course, the active policy of dissemination, because we have our newsletter, which is sent to the 4,000 addresses. And besides, every year, once or twice, we meet with different audiences, sometimes very exotic, like Argentina or China or Japan, and we speak to the audiences on the subjects that we are doing. We are supported financially not by this institute. The institute is only, so to say, for us a siege location. But financially we are supported now by the Hewlett Foundation. So that helps us, you know, just to promote our... We have also our students in this institute, some younger people who are who are our future and our hope. And I say again... Originally, it was begun as a firm choice between the alternatives of coercion and negotiation, and we opted for this negotiation. And now I'm trying, you know, to add also some more of the conflict management subjects into this research. So far, it has not acquired any material form, but I have written several papers and I'm sending them around on the possibilities of conflict management in this current situation and in the forthcoming future. And I strongly hope that maybe one day within this PIN group we shall start also maybe conflict management and negotiation.
How do you see the main difference between conflict management and negotiation?
Oh, negotiation is a tool, you know. Conflict management is a strategy. I cannot just, it's only just briefly, you know, because conflict management is a certain strategy of actions undertaken by...